Oh, I had a family reunion a couple of years ago, and it was my mother's side of the family, and we all assembled in Alstonville. Most of them I'd never met before, going back several generations, so all these distant cousins and so on. But one of the relatives in my family had done masses of research into our family history. And he stood up at the reunion and outlined some of this, talking about our ancestors and various ones of our famous ancestors, including this guy. Andreas Bodenstein von Karlstadt. Does anyone know who he is? Josiah's raising his hand. Andreas Bodenstein von Karlstadt. He was a colleague of the great Protestant reformer Martin Luther. In fact, they taught at the same university in Wittenberg. And together with Luther, he led the Protestant Reformation in Germany. Now, he and Luther subsequently had some sharp disagreements on various matters. But Karlstadt, von Karlstadt, he is my ancestor from 15 generations ago. My great times 13 grandfather. Now, admittedly, depending on how many of my distant ancestors married their cousins and so on, I could have anything around about 16,384 great times 13 grandfathers, but I'm still kind of proud of this one. Well, in the first verse of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, we read, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. When Matthew set out to write his gospel, the very first thing he wanted us to know about Jesus is that he is descended from David. Paul's magisterial letter to the Romans begins this way, Romans chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. Says Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God. What is the gospel of God about? Paul says the gospel of God is, verse 3, regarding his son, God's son, a descendant of David. This magnum opus, Paul writing to Christians he hadn't even met yet, living at the centre of Roman imperial power, and he says, this is the message I'm on about. It's about God's son, the son of David. In the final chapter of the Bible, John's vision, we read what is almost the last speech of Jesus recorded in the Bible, these words, Revelation 22, verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David. See, from beginning to end, the New Testament proclaims Jesus as the son of David. This is an integral part of the gospel. And Jesus, that Jesus is the son of David, it's significant, but not just in that he is descended from David, but also that he is like David. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say David is like Jesus. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, we began to look at this event last week. This was the event which first brought the shepherd boy David to public attention in Israel. We saw in the first half of the chapter how the Philistines had invaded Judah, and in the Valley of Elah, photo's going to come up on the screen, in the Valley of Elah, this battle, the armies were arrayed for battle. It was this strategic location, an access point to Judah for the Philistines, where their armies could enter through the midst of the hill country on either side. And for 40 days, the Philistine champion Goliath came out and challenged Israel. Challenged Israel to put forward someone who could fight him. And while this was going on in the Valley of Elah, David, the shepherd boy, was assigned this mundane task, this ordinary task by his father, Jesse, to go to the battle lines and see how David's three older brothers were doing and to bring them some provisions. And when David got there, he arrived at just the right time to hear Goliath's challenge. However, while the rest of Israel was running away in terror, David expressed outrage. 1 Samuel 17, verse 26, he said, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And in verse 31, we learn that David's confident words were heard and reported to Saul. And King Saul had David brought before him. Now, it seems like this is the first time that David and Saul met. If you've been reading through 1 Samuel, you'll know that at the end of, in the second half of chapter 16, there's an account of how David had been was brought into Saul's service as a musician, as a harp player. And yet it seems to me that that account in the second half of chapter 16 makes most sense if chronologically it actually took place after chapter 17. Because when we read chapter 16, we see particularly chapter 16 verses 18 and 19, I won't read them out, but in chapter 16 verses 18 and 19, this discussion takes place in King Saul's court. And Saul and his retainers already know many things about David, which it seems are only revealed to them in chapter 17. That is, things that they're ignorant of at the start of chapter 17, but learn during the course of chapter 17. Things like the fact that David is the son of Jesse, who lives in Bethlehem. That David's a shepherd. That he speaks well, that the Lord is with him, and that he's a brave man and a warrior. Chronologically then, if I'm right on that, if chapter 16, that episode at the end of chapter 16 takes place after chapter 17, then this verse 31, 32 is the first time Saul and David meet. Which makes it somewhat significant. The presently reigning king, the already rejected king, meets his replacement, the one who'd been chosen by God, the boy who would be king. And even though Saul has arranged this meeting, it's David who takes the initiative in verse 32 and speaks first. Verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." John Woodhouse, in his commentary on 1 Samuel, says that with these words, David proclaimed the gospel to Saul. And I think that's a beautiful description of what's taking place here in verse 32. David proclaimed the gospel to Saul. It's not yet the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not yet the good news for us. But this is the gospel of David. This is the good news for Saul, the good news for Israel. And David here says two things. He says, first, do not be afraid. See, both Saul and Israel, all Israel, had been very afraid. In verse 11, we read they'd been dismayed and terrified. In verse 24, that they ran from Goliath in fear. And yet David says to them, don't be afraid. Literally, let the heart of man not fall on account of him. Don't be afraid. Why should Israel, why should Saul have no fear before this hulking giant of a Philistine? Because of the second thing David says. I will fight. Your servant will go and fight him. Back in verse 8, Goliath had mocked the Israelites as being Saul's servants, as being Saul's slaves. But in this verse and in the conversation that follows, David gladly took on himself the role of a servant. I, your servant, will fight the Philistine for you. Now, to help you see the significance of this moment in the story of the Bible, I want you to compare David's words to Saul, and I want you to compare this Gospel of David with what an earlier statement in the Bible, what we might call the Gospel of Moses. So you remember the time when Israel had just come out of Egypt and the Egyptian army is pursuing them, and they're trapped between the Egyptian army and the sea. And this is what Moses said to them, Exodus 14, verse 13 and 14. Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today you'll never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." Now I'm just going to give you 30 seconds and I want you to compare those two verses on the screen with verse 32, 1 Samuel 17, verse 32. Chat about with the person next to you. What's the same? What's different? Got it? What's the same? What's different? I'll give you 20 or 30 seconds to get talking. All right, that's long enough. Okay, what's the same? What do you say? What's the same?
Don't lose heart.
Don't be afraid. What's different?
In one, I'll fight for you, and the other one, God will fight for you.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so the next slide, yes. Yeah. Don't be afraid. The next is, it's the Lord will fight for you, but in 1 Samuel, it's David saying, I will fight for you. See, here's a new development, a significant one. But even from a human point of view, this plan of David was preposterous. And we see that from Saul's objection in verse 33. It reminds us of how ridiculous David's plan must have seemed. Verse 33, Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy. And he has been fighting a fighting man from his youth. See, just compare the two. This Philistine, Goliath, almost 3 metres tall, covered head to foot in heavy metal armour, armed to the teeth, this seasoned, grizzled warrior. And then there's David. He hasn't even reached the age of maturity yet. He's still a lad, small, weak, inexperienced. You know, I picture this situation and, you know, the image of David that comes to my mind is like Bilbo Baggins, you know, in a group of adventurers, or one of the hobbits from Lord of the Rings, just out of place. He doesn't belong here. Only the battle in the Valley of Elah is the real world, and in the real world, midgets don't stand a chance against heavily armoured giants. Well, David preached the gospel to Saul, but Saul didn't believe him. The gospel of David seemed like foolishness in his ears. And so David responded to Saul's doubts by explaining his gospel. Verses 34 to 37. Now, and here we see that the gospel, David's gospel, had two dimensions. The first dimension, verse 34 to 36, David rescues. David rescues. Verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. See, David says, look, I may be inexperienced in war, in battle, but I've rescued in the past, and I can rescue again. This uncircumcised Philistine, he's mocked the armies of the living God. He will be nothing more than a wild animal, like those that used to threaten my father's flock. Well, Saul perhaps remained unconvinced. Literally, verse 37 starts with the words, and he said, introducing a new speech, and the way sort of dialogue to's and fro's, you'd expect it to be Saul speaking here. But actually, it's not Saul, it's David who again speaks. Saul has fallen silent. He still perhaps doesn't believe that, you know, maybe David can take on a bear or a lion, but this Philistine? But then David spoke again, giving the second dimension of his gospel, and the second dimension of his gospel is the Lord rescues. First mention, David rescues. Second, the Lord rescues. Verse 37. The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. For the first time in this chapter, David uses the covenant name of God, Yahweh, the Lord. He says that the Lord will deliver. And that Hebrew word translated as deliver it twice in verse 37 is the same word David uses of himself rescuing in verse 35. See, this is the gospel of David. It's not that it is no longer God who saves and now David who saves. It's that God would save And David would say, when David went out against lion or bear, he didn't do so alone. As David rescued the flock from the lion, God rescued David. And now when David went out against the Philistine, the same would be true today. As David rescued Israel, the Lord would rescue David. Hearing these words, Saul consented to David's plan. Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord, Yahweh, be with you." And then in verses 38 to 40, we're given this evocative picture as Saul, as the king that Israel chose for themselves, as he hands over his royal battle garb to David, the king God chose for himself. But the arms and armour, the weaponry of the king like the nations, do not fit the servant, the shepherd boy. Verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armour on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic. See, Saul equips David with his armour and weapons. In fact, it's armour and weapons that is the same as Goliath, although it's not quite as good. But David put this on and he tries walking around, but he's not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I'm not used to them." So he took them off. So we've got an image here that I think works in two directions. On the one hand, there's this metaphor, this image of royal authority being passed from Saul to David. And at the very same time, this indication that David would be a different king to Saul, who would fight with different weapons. "I cannot go in these." And so verse 40, then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. David's approach there in verse 40 is matched by the Philistines, by Goliath in verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. That phrase there, "kept coming closer to David," translates a collection of 3 verbs in the Hebrew. What we're picturing is this kind of step-by-step lumbering approach as the hulking giant Goliath reaches David or lumbers towards him. For starters, he needs to get close enough to David so he can take a look at him, this small boy. Verse 42, he looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. Goliath immediately struck by the same thing that caused Saul his doubts, that David's only a boy. Ruddy there, we might say he had rosy cheeks, or he was a fresh-faced lad. In fact, when we read these words, if we've been reading through 1 Samuel, it reminds us of words in a previous chapter where David's described in almost exactly the same way. 1 Samuel 16, verse 12, when Samuel, the prophet, first saw David. 16, verse 12, he was ruddy, with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, "Arise and anoint him, he is the one." Goliath saw the same thing, but he doesn't know the Lord's words. And he despised David. Now, I'm a bit ashamed to admit it, but a couple of nights ago, I watched a bit of Celebrity Apprentice. And one of the things that struck me, has anyone seen this? You admit it, you've done it too, haven't you? You're flicking channels and you've seen Celebrity Apprentice. Anyway, trashy show. But one of the things that struck me is that these celebrities are all highly successful people in their various fields of endeavour. And so one of the things that kept happening is whenever they're assigned to some menial task which they judge to be beneath them, they took offence. See, in their opinion, they were more worthy than that. Or if their point of view was disregarded, or ignored. They'd take offence at that too. They're used to being listened to. Well, here Goliath, similarly, he felt insulted, offended that the Israelites wouldn't take him seriously, that they'd send out this wimp to fight against him. Verse 43, he said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." So there's an irony there in verse 43. David had just finished saying Goliath would be like a bear or a lion, and then Goliath's own words diminished him further still. Not a bear, not a lion, but only a dog. And then the Philistine's action of cursing David by his gods, that reveals what this battle's truly about. Not the Israelites versus the Philistines, not even really David versus Goliath, but Yahweh the living God versus Dagon, the dead god of the Philistines. Well, David responded to Goliath's threats in verse 45 by again proclaiming his gospel. Verse 45, David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin," or perhaps scimitar, "but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." See, in verse 45, David emphatically contrasts the two combatants. You come against me, but I come against you. But the crucial difference between the two is the power on which each relies. You come with sword and spear and scimitar. Goliath, these are Goliath's weapons of war. Powerful human armaments. Instruments that can kill and maim and destroy. But I come in the name of the Lord Almighty, Yahweh of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. What's more, David adds ominously at the end of verse 45, this warrior God, Yahweh of hosts, you have defied him. You have mocked him. You've reproached him. And now I'm coming against you in his name. And then in verse 46, David announces what will happen. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I'll give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. With no fuss or fanfare, David announces what will be. Goliath's threat turned back on the Philistines. When David preached his gospel to Saul in verse 34 to 37, we notice those two dimensions. God rescues, David rescues, and God rescues. And those same two dimensions are here. In David's words to Goliath, they are both about what God will do, hand Goliath over to David, but they're also about what David will do, in fact, perhaps primarily about what David will do. I will strike you down. I will cut off your head. I will give the carcasses of the Philistines to the beast. And what's the outcome? Verse 46, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. See, the outcome is that people will know. The whole world, all the earth, verse 46, will know that there's a God in Israel. That is, they'll know that Yahweh, he is the living God, he is the true God. Not Dagon, not Baal, not Asherah, not Molech. Not Buddha, not Krishna, not Allah, not Brahma. Yahweh, he is God. And verse 47, all of those gathered there that day in the Valley of Elah would know that Yahweh saves, not by sword or spear, not by weapons of war, not by human power. Yahweh, the God who saves. And with those words still ringing in our ears, the time for battle has at last come. It's taken 47 verses in this chapter to get to this point. But at last the battle is here and once it arrives it passes quickly. Blink and you'll miss it. Verse 48. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Again, Goliath's movement there in verse 48, there are three Hebrew verbs of motion used as this monstrous Philistine slowly, relentlessly approaches David. But then there's a contrast in the second half of verse 48 as the unarmored David ran quickly to meet him. David's more sprightly movements to meet the Philistine. And then verse 49, reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. Then verse 51, David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the scabbard. He killed him and he cut off his head with the sword. There's this rapid sequence of action as the narrative accelerates. Six verbs for kind of what David does in both verse 49 and verse 51. Each introduced by naming David as the agent. Verse 49, David reached, took, slung, struck. The stone sank, and he fell. Verse 51, David ran, stood, took, drew, killed, cut off. It's a remarkable, and in the eyes of everyone present except David, a remarkable and astonishing victory. Surprising, unexpected. The shepherd boy's sling stone finds the one unarmored spot in Goliath's massive frame. And the giant topples. And then David ran up and took Goliath's sword and killed him with his own sword and cut off his head. It's so noteworthy, this victory, that the narrator interrupts his account to make sure we get the point. Verse 50 is kind of an interruption in the sequence. Verse 50, so David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. It's obviously an interruption because verse 50 preempts verse 51, which is when David actually kills Goliath. And verse 50 also picks up the two key words of verse 49 and 51 respectively. So key word of verse 49, struck. Key word of verse 51, killed. Also key words in David's gospel for Saul earlier. See, this miraculous victory accomplished without a sword, the shepherd boy who vanquished the giant. And the remaining verses in the chapter describe four outcomes of David's battle with Goliath. Four outcomes, not in chronological sequence, but each outcome in effect takes us back to this moment when David defeated the Philistine and asks, what happened next? What's the outcome of David's victory here? And it asks that question for each of four different groups of people. If you're writing notes in your outline, ignore whatever the headings I've got for the rest of it, because the rest of the talk is going to be four outcomes. Four outcomes. Outcome one, the Philistines are routed. Verse 51, end of verse 51. When the Philistines saw their hero was dead, they turned and ran. In verse 9, Goliath had promised that if an Israelite would come and defeat him, the Philistines would agree to be the Israelite slaves. But now they renege on that promise, if they ever intended to keep it. They probably thought they'd never have to keep it with someone like Goliath. And they turn and they flee for their lives. In fact, that word translated turned and ran or fled in verse 51, it's been used only once before in this chapter, in verse 24, which is when the men of Israel saw Goliath and they ran from him. See, now the tables have been turned. Before Israel fled from Goliath, now the Philistines flee from David. But David's victory had brought courage to the men of Israel. They could see that the battle was won. And so outcome two is for the Israelites, victory is handed to them. Verse 52, then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Sha'arim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. So a couple of things going on here. First, verse 52 we read that of this defeat and slaughter of their enemies. And then the map's going to come on the screen. You might be able to read there. Gath and Ephron, those two red circles kind of in the middle, were the Philistine cities closest to this battlefield. And the Sha'arim road, Sha'arim means literally two gates. So possibly this is a road which then forked towards the gates of these two cities. And along this road lie the corpses of the Philistine army, the enemy totally defeated. Just as David had promised in verse 46, their dead bodies left exposed for the wild beasts. And then the second thing, after this slaughter of the enemies, verse 53, is that Israel enjoy the plunder, the spoils of victory. Outcome one, the Philistines. Outcome two, the Israelites. Outcome three, David, verse 54. So again, it takes us back to that moment where David's just defeated Goliath. Verse 54, David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. And he put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent. So the narrative focuses our attention back on David, still standing over Goliath's corpse, as the armies begin to surge into motion. And we're given these two intriguing details. First, the Philistine's weapon. Well, that's actually given second. But the Philistine's weapon. They're going to have a part to play later in 1 Samuel. But that here, the placing of these weapons in David's tent demonstrates that this victory belongs to David. He is the one who has defeated the enemy. Second detail, the Philistine's head brought to Jerusalem. Now what makes this particularly intriguing is that at this time, the time of this battle, Israel did not possess Jerusalem. It wasn't a city of Israel. There were still Canaanites living in it. So it brings us to us, when did David take Goliath's head to Jerusalem? Does it mean that David kind of marched up to Jerusalem and chucked it over the wall of the city to taunt his enemies there? I don't think so. I think rather it's a verse that points us forward in time. Jerusalem isn't mentioned again in the Bible until 2 Samuel chapter 5. And 2 Samuel chapter 5 describes how David's first act as king of all Israel is to attack Jerusalem and make it his royal capital. So what's the narrator saying here? What's this comment saying? It's saying David's march to Jerusalem began here. David's ascent to the throne of Israel began here with his first victory. The first time he went out in the name of the Lord to save God's people. The one who went out, the one who fought the battle, the one who saved God's people, he is the one who would be lifted up to the throne and exalted as their king. Outcome three, David. Outcome for Saul. We're given another flashback. Initially taking us back, in fact, to the very beginning of the battle as David was going out to meet Goliath in verse 55 to 58. We won't read all of these verses, but the emphasis here is Saul's watching what David does, and this is his question. Three times, verse 55. Whose son is that young man? Verse 56, the king said, find out whose son that young man is. Verse 58, whose son are you, young man? Saul still describes David just as he had before, as a young man, a boy, a youth, a lad. But his interest is piqued. Even though we already know the answer to the question, we know whose son David is. King Saul's question raises our suspense. It draws our attention. Whose son is this young man? See, we see here that Saul is unaware. He's blind. He's ignorant. He doesn't know who stands before him. He doesn't know who went out to fight the Philistine. He doesn't know who won the victory. He doesn't perceive the significance of this moment. Finally, David supplies the crucial piece of information. I am the son of your servant Jesse of Bethlehem. Words which again drive us back to 1 Samuel 16 verse 1 on the screen, I think. 1 Samuel 16 verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way, and go, I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem, for I have seen among his sons a king for myself. David, the son of Jesse, the one chosen by God as a king for himself. Well, if Jesus is the son of David, what does David's gospel show us about Jesus' gospel? If Jesus is the son of David, what does David's gospel show us about Jesus' gospel? I want you to just chat again with the person next to you. I wanted to give you a little bit more time for that, but we're running a little bit short, so I'm only going to give you a minute. But there's the question on the screen. What does the Gospel of David show us about the Gospel of Jesus? You don't have to look up those verses. I'm happy for you just to chat about things we've seen from this passage. But if you're stumped, you've got nothing to say, look up one of those verses and have a think about it. So talk to the person next to you. What does the Gospel of David show us about the Gospel of Jesus? Away you go. All right, we've got to leave it there, but you might want to talk about more things. I think there are lots of things, and I'm not going to say all of them now, so I think there's more for you to explore and think about. Points of connection between this chapter and the Gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm just going to say three things. First, we see that we have a fearsome enemy. For Israel, it was Goliath, that 3-metre-tall behemoth. For us, it is the triumvirate of sin, death, and Satan. These cosmic powers, these enemies before whom we are powerless, enemies we cannot fight, like the armies of Israel, trembling where we stand, we have a fearsome enemy. Now, we get the gospel of Jesus wrong when we underestimate our enemy. When we think that Jesus came to make our life better, or to improve our marriages, or to give us health, or to give us prosperity. In truth, what enemy did Jesus come to? He came to crush sin. He came to overthrow the devil. He came to conquer death. Don't underestimate your enemy. Secondly, we see from the Gospel of David that so too in the Gospel of Jesus we have a servant who fought the battle for us. One who came not to be served but to serve. A son of David who rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, who came in the name of the Lord, and who on a hill outside the walls of Jerusalem stretched out his arms and fought the battle. Friends, we get the gospel of Jesus wrong when we think that it's we who fight the battle ourselves, that it's up to our strength, that it's up to our efforts to stop sinning. Friends, Israel didn't defeat Goliath, David did, and we did not defeat sin. The good news is that Jesus came and fought the battle for us. And thirdly, we learn that there is a surprising victory. Not with sword or spear, not with human power, not with weapons of war, but with 2 beams of wood, 3 nails, and a crown of thorns. And so, friends, we get the gospel of Jesus wrong when we're afraid, as if the outcome was still in doubt, as if there was still some question, when in fact the victory has been won. The battle has been fought, and now all that remains is for Jesus to deliver to us the spoils. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God. He gives us the victory through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.